This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. A special edition of the Florida Roundup this Friday, the case of the Cuban Five. In late February 1996, two Cessna planes flown by Brothers to the Rescue pilots were shot down by a Cuban Air Force MiG-29 jet. They were shot down in international airspace. Two pilots and two passengers were killed. Marlene Alejandre is the daughter of one of those pilots, Armando Alejandre. The incident led to the United Nations Security Council condemnation. The U.S. Congress eventually passed what was called the Helms-Burton Act, which tightened the U.S. trade embargo against Cuba. And the arrest of the five Cuban agents in South Florida happened in 1998. That group has become known as the Cuban Five, Los Cinco. Rene Gonzalez is one of the Cuban Five who is out of prison, the only one out of prison. And he spoke last week, as a matter of fact, at a rally in Cuba about the return of his co-defendants. The issue has become back up on our agenda here in South Florida 15 years after the arrest of the Cuban Five. A new book published argues for their innocence. We will talk with that book's author in a moment and one of the U.S. prosecutors that successfully got the convictions against the Cuban Five. First, WLRN America's editor Tim Padgett joins me here on the Florida Roundup. Tim, what was this case about?
Well, the Cuban Five are Gerardo Hernandez, Rene Gonzalez, Fernando Gonzalez, Ramon Labanino, and Antonio Guerrero. They were part of a spy ring out of communist Cuba known as the WASP network that worked its way into the U.S. and Miami in the 1990s. They claim their sole mission was to ferret out persons and groups inside the Cuban exile community who were plotting terrorist acts inside Cuba, and they did have some reason to be concerned. Two Havana hotels were bombed in 1997, for example, and both Cuban and U.S. authorities suspected Cuban exiles, one in particular named Luis Posada Carriles. But as you said, in September of 1998, a number of WASP network members, including the Cuban Five, were arrested on conspiracy to commit espionage against U.S. military facilities here in Florida. Most important, one of them was charged with conspiracy to commit murder.
That was the most significant charge in the case of the Cuban Five. Others were charged with conspiracy to commit espionage, essentially planning to spy on the U.S. military. And there were also some other various charges in regards to the use of fake documents and some other conspiracy charges.
So after a long trial, the Cuban Five were convicted in 2001 and given prison sentences ranging from 15 years to life.
Life prison sentence was because of the conspiracy to murder charge.
To commit murder in the case of the four Cuban exiles whose small unarmed planes were shot down by Cuban jet fighters there in 1996. The federal courts ultimately denied their appeals. And I should mention that one of them, as you said, Rene Gonzalez, has since been paroled and allowed to return to Cuba. Back in Cuba, Los Cinco, as they're known, are considered national heroes. But around the world, including the U.S., people continue to insist the Cubans are innocent or at least did not receive a fair trial here in anti-communist Miami.
There's a lot of politics wrapped up in this, but we're going to really focus on kind of the legal case and some of the arguments that a new book that's being published, and we'll speak with the author that makes and argues for the innocence of the of Los Cinco. We'll also speak, as we mentioned, with one of the prosecutors who was arguing on the behalf of the U.S. government to this case in 1998, 99, and 2000. But give us a sense of what was going on in Miami, the environment in which this case began.
Well, what they say, and that's certainly the contention of the book that we're going to be talking about today, they say that it's especially true they feel that they could not have gotten a fair trial here because the trial and the appeals took place in this atmosphere of the Alien Gonzalez drama, which most of us remember here, which heightened anti-Castro fervor in Miami and generally post 9/11 America.
And so because the conviction came prior to 9/11 and the sentencing came after 9/11.
Exactly.
These are key dates, obviously, to remember. It was a long case, and here we are 15 years after the fact, speaking about this in part because of the new book being published. But why does this case still resonate here in South Florida, but even more generally on the international scale?
Well, it still matters for two main reasons. The first reason is named Alan Gross. He's the 64-year-old U.S. AIDS subcontractor who was arrested in 2009 in Cuba on fairly questionable espionage charges after delivering communications equipment to the island's Jewish community. He was convicted and is now serving his own 15-year prison term. And there's a widespread belief that the Cubans will never free Gross until the U.S. frees one or more of the Cuban Five. The other reason is that both the Cuban Five and Alan Gross cases remain a major obstacle to thawing U.S.-Cuba relations, which could have an effect on Cuba's democratization and economic modernization in the long run.
We are going to be getting into this with the author of the new book, as well as one of the prosecutors that prosecuted this case back 15 years ago here on the Florida Roundup, a special edition. It is the case of the Cuban Five. Your show as well. Let us know what your comments are. Email us at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. You can tweet us at WLRN is the handle, at WLRN, or go to the live chat online at WLRN.org. And still to come here on this Florida Roundup, Stephen Kimber, the author of the new book, What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five, and one of the U.S. attorneys who prosecuted that case. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN, a new look at the case of the Cuban Five. I'm Tom Hudson along with Tim Padgett. 15 years after the original arrest of the Five, Stephen Kimber, a journalism professor at University of King's College in Halifax, Canada, has written a new book entitled What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five. And he joins us from Canada. Professor Kimber, welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN.
Thank you very much.
David Buckner is along with us as well, an assistant U.S. attorney back in 1998. He was on the team which successfully prosecuted the Cuban Five case, convictions which have been upheld on appeal. David is with us in Miami. He is partner with the law firm now, Grossman Roth. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Your questions are welcome to the panel as well at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. Tweet us with the call sign at WLRN and with the live chat on the website at WLRN.org. Professor Kimber, tell us, first of all, what you think is misunderstood about the prosecution of the Cuban Five.
Well, let me start with a couple of things. One thing that you didn't mention was that I was invited to appear on another show on your station.
You are, yes, Professor, and I don't mean to interrupt, but really want to talk about this case right now.
I think it is important,
Professor,
that
you're here right now to talk about the case. So let's talk about the case. Respectfully, the decision was made to make this a news program to talk about the case of the Cuban Five 15 years after the fact. And that's what we would like to talk
I'm
about.
I'm happy
and
to
I know
talk
that
about the
what
case.
I would
appreciate
well.
The opportunity, though, to put it into some sort of context.
We've given you plenty of opportunity to put the case in context. That's what we're here to discuss.
What was the opportunity that I had to put the case in context, sir?
Tell us what you think is misunderstood about the case of the Cuban Five.
Well, let's start. First of all, the book, I'm told that I was presupposing the innocence of the Cuban Five. I didn't presuppose anything. I came to this case as a journalist, as somebody who found this a fascinating story, not somebody who had an axe to grind in the case. I read the transcript of the case, the 20,000 plus pages. I went through the boxes of evidence that were presented at the case, and I interviewed dozens of people, including, of course, the members of the Cuban Five. But I also went through the thousands of news stories from the Miami Herald and other Miami publications to sort of try to put the context in. The book itself covers the period from 1990 when the first of the agents arrived until 1998 when they were arrested. And mm-hmm. I used the trial to try and put what they were doing in context. And if you want to understand what the Cuban Five were doing in Florida, I think that the easiest way to do that is to put it in American terms. Somebody mentioned 9/11. Well, let's think about 9/11 for a second and think about what would have happened if the United States had had agents in Afghanistan in the period before 9/11 and they'd been able to infiltrate Al-Qaeda and they were able to get a message back about the impending attacks on the United States. And if in that case the United States or the Afghan government, instead of arresting the terrorists who were planning the attack, arrested the agents who'd developed the information in the first place. I think that's, if you look at it that way, you see what the Cubans see about this case.
Mm-hmm. This Cuban Five, a number of them were arrested, and the main charge was conspiracy to commit espionage. That gets to your point trying to draw the parallel. Correct. I didn't say all of them. I said most of them. The main charge was conspiracy to commit espionage. And getting to your analogy between Afghanistan and the United States, these were agents of the Cuban government supposedly spying not only on individual Americans, but also convicted of conspiring to spy on U.S. military operations.
Well, let's start with what they were actually doing there. And again, the context is important. If you think about cases in which guys like Tony Bryant of Commandos L, he talked to the Miami Herald about being interviewed by the FBI about a boat of his that was loaded with explosives that turned up near Havana. And what the FBI said to him was, don't do it again. And he says, I promise not to do it again, and they went away. You can look at Rodolfo Formetta, 1994, stopped three times with illegal weapons, no charges, finally charged only after trying to buy a Stinger missile that he said was going to be used in Cuba. And he was sentenced to 4 years in jail. So if you looked at it from the Cuban perspective, there were things that were going on that needed to be investigated. The American government was not doing the investigation. These were the kinds of terrorist attacks that were being planned. And somebody mentioned the hotel bombings, said two hotels were bombed. More than a dozen hotels were bombed. There was a Canadian Italian-Canadian businessman who was killed and dozens of other people injured. So to say two hotels were bombed really doesn't cut it. And those plots were actually planned in the United States, and they violated U.S. neutrality laws. There was no attempt to investigate and arrest those people.
I mentioned the two hotel bombings in particular because
there weren't two. There were more than a dozen.
I understand. So I mentioned just those two. I said because those involved one of the main conspirators that you're referring to, Luis Posada Carriles.
Actually, all of them involved that main conspirator.
Well, the FBI implicates him in just those two, as far as I understand.
Well, let's put this to a prosecutor who was on the case. Dave Buckner joins us here in the studio, Professor. Dave, you've heard the professor kind of lay out some of the context, the broader context in which these five gentlemen were in the United States, the Cuban perspective that he is bringing to this. Was there a willful ignorance, shall I say, on the part of U.S. prosecutors back in the 90s in regards to some of the activity that the professor laid out?
No, there wasn't. And this is one of the things that has sort of arisen up out of this case over time, is what I'd call a willful ignorance on the part of people like Professor Kimber, with all respect, who look at a specific little slice of the record evidence in this case, which is voluminous. Remember, the FBI successfully decrypted these spies' communications with the Home Office in Havana over the course of an extended period of time. So we have their communications and their high-frequency radio communications coming back from Havana up here, giving them their instructions. We have, and by virtue of this trial, the jury had, and now the public has, a voluminous record of what these gentlemen, these spies, were actually up to. And if you look at what was presented at trial, the government presented 3, 4, or 5-inch binders full of their communications talking about their efforts to penetrate the United States Southern Command, the warfighting command for the Southern Hemisphere for the United States, penetrate military bases around the country, monitoring the movements of aircraft and personnel, trying to get inside of facilities that they themselves recognized were top secret facilities and did in fact contain classified national defense information. All of that was in those—
Did they find any classified information?
Can I finish, please? So that's in those three binders. The defense was given the opportunity to go through the same body of evidence that the government did and put on its case. And they put on the case that the professor's talking about, that these spies were here trying to infiltrate supposedly Cuban exile groups that were plotting acts of violence in Cuba. And their binder, I will tell you, was a very thin one. And it's not to say that that doesn't happen, but to say that the U.S. government, that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, that the United States Attorney's Office, the United States Department of Justice ignored that little part of the case, we didn't ignore that part of the case, but it was such a small part of the case compared to what they were charged with.
Well, and what you're talking about, Dave, is the defense of necessity, and we'll talk about that in a moment. And Professor, you talk about the defense of necessity as well. Tim,
well,
Padgett.
And Professor Kimber, in your book, you in response to Dave's assertions here, you say in your book that the five, quote, hadn't come close to penetrating Southcom or the Boca Chica naval station, that really wasn't their intent. Can you lay out for us why you feel then that the espionage, you know, the conspiracy to commit espionage mm-hmm. charges were not valid?
I don't say they weren't valid. I think one of the things that the Cuban government has not done very well is that they've tried to gloss over the fact that there was a military mission that was certainly part of what three of these agents were doing. But I think that the military mission that we're talking about here is defensive. The Cubans had the example of Haiti, Panama, Grenada, where there had been American invasions of those countries in the years prior to this. And they were understandably concerned about any possible invasion of their own country. What it seems to me from reading the evidence that was the most important thing from the Cuban point of view was to find out if there was any indications that that there was an invasion in planning. And they had come up with indicators that they were looking for. An increase in the number of planes arriving at southern U.S. Naval Station, Boca Chica, those kinds of things. They were also very concerned about the move of the Southern Command headquarters from Panama to Miami in the mid-1990s, and what that might mean. It put the U.S. command that much closer to Cuba, but it also meant that from their point of view, they were under the they could be under the influence of the exile community. So I think that there certainly were things that they were looking for. Now, did they want other things? Did Cuban intelligence want other things? I think there's no question that they did. They were like intelligence agencies everywhere in the world. They wanted to vacuum up every piece of information and try to analyze it. They did, they asked Tony Guerrero, who was one of the five, to become more friendly with this guy that he'd become friends with, who happened to be an 18-year-old kid. He went to his wedding and he took his wedding photographs. An evidence of some sort of deep penetration and infiltration. Guerrero was a janitor. He didn't, in fact, if you look at the court record, it wasn't his idea even to apply at the base. That came from an employment counselor in Key West. So he applied to the base. He got a job as a janitor. He barely spoke English. When he was asked for important stuff, he sent back newspaper clippings. This is not a guy who was, at a pay grade or a possibility of trying to get at serious intelligence secrets.
Professor Stephen Kimber is along with us from Halifax in Canada. He has written a new book called What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm along with Tim Padgett. And Dave Buckner also joins us, a former U.S. attorney prosecutor that was involved in the Cuban Five case 15 years ago. Dave, the charge with three of those Cuban Five, among the charges, conspiracy to gather and transmit national defense information. And among the scenarios that the book lays out and that the professor just spoke about was they may have been, yes, the Cuban government was interested in certainly espionage, but these guys were in no position to actually get the details, get the actual data.
Sure. The problem with that...
Is there a distinction in the law?
Well, first of all, there's a couple of problems with the professor's theory. First of all, a conspiracy doesn't require that you actually obtain whatever the object of the conspiracy is. It's enough that you...
That's a really important point. I don't want to interrupt you except to say that, it's important to recognize they weren't charged with espionage. They were charged with conspiracy. In the same case, a conspiracy to commit murder The requirements are quite different.
Yes, it is an important point, and we've given it full air here, charged with conspiracy to commit espionage, not espionage.
Correct, and I think what the professor is saying is that we made the right charging decision.
By the way, they were also convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage.
Correct, and not only were they convicted, but those convictions were upheld.
Are we two of you sort of ganging up here? Is that what we're doing?
Actually,
we're laying out the facts of the case.
Actually, Professor, I'd like to just finish talking. I was very polite and let you talk during your time. I'd appreciate it if you do the same for me.
I appreciate that.
So first of all, you're right. Conspiracy is different than the actual completed act. And it's enough that they conspired, that is, they agreed to obtain that whatever the object of the conspiracy is, in this case, non-public national defense information, and they took concrete steps to accomplish that. That's what they were charged with, and that's what they were convicted of. The professor is trying to imply that there is not a volume of evidence as to the actual intent of these gentlemen. Antonio Guerrero was on the Boca Chica Naval Air Station. We have, as I said, their communications back and forth. It's in the public record about what they were trying to do. I'll give you just one example. During the time he was there, the Boca Chica Naval Air Station started constructing a classified information storage facility on the base to contain classified information. And the professor says, well, he's just a janitor. Well, he was working at that facility. He recognized, because of his intelligence training by the Cuban Directorate of Intelligence, that this facility would be used for classified information. He made a detailed mental blueprint, as he says, in his communications back to Havana, back to his handlers, so that he could convey that to them. He took note of the security measures in place. He did everything he could to determine what that building was going to be used for and figure out ways to penetrate it. Intelligence gathering, as this case developed, is a long-term proposition. It doesn't matter which intelligence agency we're talking about, whether it's the Cuban intelligence agency or anyone else. Antonio Guerrero and the other two agents charged with conspiracy to commit espionage were part of a long-term effort to penetrate the United States military. They were putting together the building blocks to make those penetrations possible. They were gathering information, as I said, about troop movements, about the secure classified facility, and a variety of other things, which shows what their intent was. That was to gather non-public national defense information.
Professor, I want to continue on this point of conspiracy here, but I do have to address the fact that your accusation of ganging up. Nobody's ganging up on you here. Conflict, I know, is the source of good drama, but civility is where real insight begins, and that's what we're having here is a civil conversation.
Well, you were having a civil conversation, but at the same time, you weren't allowing me to talk about what, in fact, is the context for this interview.
Well, the context of the interview, again, is your book. This is a news program, not a talk program. This is a program in regards to current affairs and public affairs in South Florida and Miami, and that's why we're here. I do want to discuss this conspiracy charge here just a little bit more, and your thoughts on reading the record that you go through in your book. The conspiracy charge, according to the trial judge, according to the appeals court in Atlanta that looked over this case as well, require proof of the intent only to do the acts that the law prescribes. The government does not need to prove that the defendants accomplished the purpose of the conspiracy. So is your reading of the record that the three accused of intent were guilty or not?
I would say that at a very low level, they were guilty.
Are there different levels
one
of
them,
guilt,
you know,
I suppose?
Gerardo Hernandez was sentenced to life imprisonment for that.
But that has, if I could interject, Professor, this is Tim Padgett. This moves us then to the murder conspiracy charge, and again,
it actually doesn't. One of the convictions, as I understand it, was for conspiracy to commit espionage, and one of the sentences was in connection with that.
Yeah, that is true. That is Antonio Guerrero.
Right.
He was convicted of
No. Antonio Guerrero and Gerardo, and I believe Ramon, were all sentenced to life imprisonment originally.
Originally, but actually on
appeal. In terms of the conspiracy to commit espionage. So
correct. Well, and let me correct you, though, Professor. You're right. Originally, they were sentenced to life in prison on that count, but those sentences were subsequently reduced based on certain issues with regard to the U.S. sentencing guidelines, that really kind of technical issues about how you sentence conspiracy. And this shows, by the way, that the system works. When those sentences ultimately went up on appeal, the convictions for conspiracy to commit espionage, the sentences, the life sentences that were given out by the district court judge, the appellate court said, well, we think you misinterpreted the sentencing guidelines, and those particular sentences were reduced. So only at this point, at least unless something's changed that I don't know about, only Gerardo Hernandez is currently serving a life sentence.
Professor,
that's true. But we're talking about the trial, so we're talking about what they were convicted of and what they were sentenced
to.
That's
right.
Well, but I think it's important here because there's a lot of false information that's come up around this case. This is a perfect example of how our system works. It was reviewed on appeal because the appellate court felt that the district court judge didn't do the sentencing right, misinterpreted a relatively esoteric part of the sentencing guidelines. those sentences were reduced. If this was a setup, if this was a railroading, that never would have happened. And that certainly wouldn't have ever happened in Cuba, but it happened here because our system works.
Professor, if we could move to the more serious charge of mm-hmm. the murder conspiracy. In your book, you make the claim that whatever plans a Mint or the Interior Ministry in Cuba or the military would have had to shoot down these planes, as you say, quote, certainly wouldn't have filtered down to, as you term it, you know, sort of lower level operatives like the Cuban Five here in who were here in Florida at that time. How can you, I was hoping that you could explain to us why you're so certain that whatever was being planned in Havana wouldn't have filtered down back to these gentlemen, since whatever Minute was deciding and the military was deciding was based a lot on the information that they were receiving from the operatives based here.
Actually, there was nothing that they were receiving from the operatives in, well, I shouldn't say that. There were some things, but generally speaking, the shoot down and the case of the Cuban Five, or what the Cuban Five were doing here, were quite distinct. The Brothers to the Rescue group were flying into Cuban airspace in an attempt to provoke the Cuban government. That goes back to sort of almost a year. And you can see in the book, and the book is taken from largely from the trial transcripts at the time and messages that were sent from the FAA about these incursions into Cuban airspace, the protests from the Cuban government, the attempts that were made by the Cuban government essentially to say to the United States, look, if you don't stop these guys from committing illegal acts of coming into Cuban airspace, we'll do it for you. And that is essentially what in the end that they did. Now, what was happening on the ground with the Cuban Five, they had agents, Rene Gonzalez being one, and another one called Juan Pablo Roque, inside Brothers to the Rescue. Those agents were reporting back to Havana on things that they saw and conversations that they had that indicated to them that Brothers to the Rescue were not simply just going to fly over Havana and drop leaflets, that they had more sinister objects in mind. So there was that concern at the level of the Cuban government. So in the lead up to that, but what was happening on the ground at the same time that this dispute was going on between Brothers to the Rescue and the United States government and the Cuban government, because the United States government took a very active role in trying to stop Brothers to the Rescue, was that Juan Pablo Roque, the agent inside Brothers to the Rescue, wanted to go home. And there was an attempt to try and bring him home and get publicity value from that. And so Gerardo Hernandez was charged with organizing that. That was part of his job. And that was an operation that was described as Operation Venezia in the documents. There was also, at the same time, something called Operation Scorpion. And that was what was described in one of the documents as an attempt to perfect the confrontation between Brothers to the Rescue and the Cuban government. What did that mean? And the prosecutors interpreted that as meaning that this was the plan for a shoot down. Now, there was a shoot-down planned, and I think if you look at it, what you'll see is that the U.S. Cuban government, Fidel Castro had said to his military, and military separate from the intelligence here, had said to his military, if they do this again, you have authority basically to shoot them down. Right. So intelligence is trying to get Juan Pablo Roque back and make a publicity coup out of it. And Gerardo Hernandez is working on that. The message that comes through about Operation Scorpion is, in fact, not addressed directly to him. It is addressed mm-hmm. right. to another agent who actually went back to Cuba and didn't end up
right.
in.
Right, and you make that point. You make that point in your book, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, and so his there's an affidavit that Gerardo Hernandez filed later. And you know, it's important that he did not testify at trial, and it's understandable that this evidence wouldn't have been there. There are two things about that he claims that Manny Ruiz, who is the other agent, had the beeper, and therefore he didn't know, he wasn't directly involved in this message. And there were a couple of reasons why that makes sense. One is that the message uses a code name for Rene Gonzalez that is not one that he used. The other one is that the actual I just lost my train of thought there, but the second one had to do with the fact that he didn't have the beeper at that time.
Right.
So, you know, his role in all of this seems to be curious at best. You know, it's not clear. And I think that when you convict somebody of conspiracy to commit murder, you need more than the kind of evidence that they had. Now, dissenting judge at the Court of Appeals thought that as well. So does Amnesty International. So do other people.
Well, then, Professor, if you could just let me ask Dave then. Dave, why was the prosecution so convinced that there was a connection between Havana and Gerardo Hernandez going on here vis-a-vis Operation Scorpion?
Okay, and let me go through that. And this is, you know, there's a lot of evidence here, and obviously we can't talk all about it today, but one of the parts that first convinced us that Gerardo Hernandez was involved is that he's back in Havana when Operation Venecia, which is the exfiltration operation for Juan Pablo Roque, turns into Operation Escorpión. And that's a critical change because it goes from being an exfiltration operation to a shootdown and exfiltration operation. And Gerardo Hernandez is back in Havana, and we argue to the jury he's back in Havana because he's setting this up. He comes back, he gets these messages that instruct him to do a number of things. First, he is to instruct the agents, Juan Pablo Roque and Rene Gonzalez, the two infiltrators and Brothers to the Rescue, to report on all of Brothers to the Rescue's movements, when they're flying, where they'll be flying, what equipment they'll be using, who's on the planes. They're also instructed, Gerardo Hernandez is instructed by the Home Office in Havana to instruct his agents, do not fly on February 24th, 25th, 26th, and 27th, which was when Concilio Cubano was meeting in Cuba. That, as you'll recall, was the organization trying to foster an opening of the Cuban political system and reconciliation between Cubans both in Cuba and abroad. And they were told not to fly on those days. And if they were going to have to fly on these days, they were supposed to let the Cuban intelligence service know immediately. And if for some reason they were forced to fly on those days without having given the Cuban intelligence service advance warning, they were given specific code words to say into the radio so that the Cuban intelligence service and, more importantly, the Cuban military would know that Cuban agents were on board the aircraft and therefore not to shoot them down. And the problem with looking at, you know, what the professor's doing is looking at a very narrow part of the story. He's making an argument that the defense certainly made to the jury, but when you look at all the evidence, the jury was certainly entitled to find, as the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals found, there was more than sufficient evidence to convict Gerardo Hernandez of murder. And let's not forget, if I might add, those two Brothers to the Rescue aircraft that were shot down never entered Cuban airspace. They were shot down in cold blood without warning in international airspace.
Oh, wait a minute. Now, wait
by
a minute.
A Cuban... Let me finish, Professor.
But now what you're talking about is something different than the case.
No, sir. The case is about the murder of four people who were killed in international airspace when their unarmed civilian aircraft were shot out of the sky by a Soviet-built fighter plane. And I've listened, as I hope you have, to the fighter aircraft communication between ground control in Havana and the Cuban Air Force personnel who shot those planes down, and they're exultant, and it's offensive. And they killed four people in international airspace.
You say that, but have you ever heard military conversations after a mission of any sort? I'm talking about Americans, Cubans. If they achieve their mission, they're going to do that, right?
No, sir. Actually, the military
they're
professionals.
Respectful,
let me
are they?
Finish, please. The military professionals that I've been involved in during my time working with the United States government were professionals. I would not expect them to do that, nor have I ever heard them do that.
David Buckner is with the law firm Grossman and Roth. He was the assistant attorney general with the prosecution in the trial of the Cuban Five. Stephen Kimberlong with us, a professor at University King's College in Halifax. He is the author of a new book in examining the case of the Cuban Five, which we're doing here on a special edition of the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson along with Tim Padgett, and we will continue this conversation in a moment. I will point out we are having this conversation conversation, in part, as the professor has alluded to earlier, an interview schedule that was on this radio station earlier in the week that had been canceled. As a news department at WLRN, we decided that the case that the professor makes in the book is of public interest here in South Florida for obvious reasons, and we have invited him on the program to discuss the context of his book, and we've also invited David Buckner on to provide the counter opinion, since Mr. Buckner was on the prosecution team with the U.S. Attorney's Office back in 1998 prosecuting the Cuban Five. We will continue this conversation talking about the conspiracy of murder charge against one of the individuals, also talking about questions in regards to the jury in South Florida and the venue in South Florida for this highly politicized case. Still to come on the Florida Roundup. This is the Florida Roundup, a special edition here on WLRN. It is a new look at the case of the Cuban Five. I'm Tom Hudson, along with Tim Padgett. Stephen Kimber, journalism professor at University of King's College in Halifax, Canada, is along with us. His new book has been published, What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five. And David Buckner, an assistant U.S. attorney back in 1998, prosecuting that case. David is with us here in Miami, now a partner at the law firm Grossman Roth. Among the real contentions and points of controversy here, David, have been the venue in which this trial was held, that being, of course, Miami and the Federal District Court, and, of course, the jury selection process. Was this a political prosecution?
Not at all. Not at all. And one of the ways that you know that the system works, and I think that's, you know, when I think back to this trial, really of everything that strikes me most powerfully, it's how well our system worked, how flexible our system of justice is to be able to deal with high-profile trials like this. Because this is not going to be the first high-profile trial. It certainly wasn't. And it won't be the last. I mean, we're going to end up probably someday prosecuting al-Qaeda terrorists in this country. And you're going to have to find a way to pick a jury that's able to fairly and impartially decide.
Odds are those cases would not be held in the Federal District Court of Southern New York in Manhattan.
Well, you say that, but I don't know that that's
true. We don't know if that's true or not.
And the fact is, do you really think that there are Americans in any part of the country that don't have a feeling about al-Qaeda at this point in history? And that's why, and that's the point here. Let's talk about what happened. So the district court judge in this case, Judge Joan Leonard, is a terrific jurist. And she recognized early on, as did frankly all the parties, the defense and the government, that there was going to be a lot of media attention to this case, and that there were going to be strong feelings, perhaps, among certain members of the community people who would not be appropriate to sit as jurors. And so the defense, the government, and the court worked together for months to come up with a system for jury selection that would do what jury selection is supposed to accomplish, that is, weed out those who have opinions that are so strong they can't sit fairly and impartially on a particular case. And I will tell you, having tried many cases over my career, there are just some kinds of cases that certain people can't sit on. A parent who's lost a child probably is not a good juror in a case where a child is alleged to have died as a result of someone's wrongdoing. It's just not a case they should sit on. Well, this is no different. And so the judge devised a two-step jury selection process. The first step was that every juror on the voir dire was questioned about general issues, about their lives, about the kinds of things that happen in courts in the United States every day.
That would be standard operating procedure to sit any jury in any case, certainly any criminal case.
Correct. You find out what people do for a living, their biographies and whatever else.
What do their families do? Do they have any connection to the criminal justice system? All those kinds
exactly.
of questions.
But then we went to step two. And step two was a one-at-a-time, individualized inquiry with the government lawyers, the defense lawyers, and the judge in the room, in the courtroom, inquiring of the jurors of a series of topics, Elian Gonzalez, Cuban-American politics, a number of issues, to see if they had feelings that would make it impossible for them to sit in judgment. As that process continued, the defense, remember, they moved to change the venue, but their ultimate change of venue motion was really just to move this case to Fort Lauderdale. So somehow, the idea that this was going to end up in Kansas, that wasn't even on the table. But that motion was pending, and the judge basically said, look, we're going to try and pick a jury. If we can pick a fair jury, great. If defense, you don't think we can, at the end, you don't think we have, you can renew your motion.
But if I could ask Professor Kimber then, along these lines, one of the contentions you make, Professor, that has to do even before the trial, having to do with the arrests themselves. You contend that these were, as Tom mentioned before, politically motivated, that if this had not been, if this had been a case of spies from other countries, it might have been handled differently, either deportation or something of that nature. You contend that this was an effort by the part of the Justice Department and the FBI to appease, as you said in your book, powerful Cuban-American institutions here like the Cuban-American National Foundation.
I think that that definitely is part of it. I mean, in fact, if you look at the case, what's really interesting to me is that there was no good reason to arrest these particular individuals at the time that they were arrested. What we do know from the court records is that for at least 2 years before they were arrested, the FBI were following them. And as David Buckner said, that you know that they were able to decrypt the messages going back and forth between Havana and Miami. So they knew what was going on, and they were learning, I think, probably a treasure trove of information about what, in fact, was going on in this case. By arresting them, they immediately stopped that. They didn't get that information. The Cubans were going to, you know, inevitably change their methods of communicating, and suddenly the whole process that was working for the FBI, and because of the fact that, you know, there was nothing, and I think it's fair to say that if you look at the evidence, there was nothing specific that they were doing that was endangering American security at the time, why not keep following them? Part of the reason for that, I think, and this is something that I don't know, because I did try to get information through Freedom of Information from the FBI about what happened between a meeting in Havana between FBI agents and Cuban state security officials, which happened in June of 1998, and 3 months later, when the members of the Cuban Five were arrested, what changed? Because, in fact, the United States got evidence that they said they were going to investigate. They got information about certain people that the Cubans believed were involved in terrorist acts in the United States. And instead of arresting any of those people or seriously at that point investigating the allegations that the Cubans had made, they turned around and arrested these guys that they already knew about.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that there was not a good reason to do that. So from the, you know, I mean, I'm thinking here from an American intelligence point of view, and certainly there were protests, as I understand it, from FBI agents on the ground that this was not the right decision to turn this into a criminal investigation. So why did they do that? I think that part of it had to do with Hector Pescara, who was the Miami bureau chief, who became very close to the exiles. Some of those exiles were people who the Cubans claimed were terrorists.
The bureau chief of the Federal Bureau of Investigations. We should get
exactly
that in there.
Sorry.
So, Professor,
yes.
You've got two interesting points here wrapped up. One is the timing of the arrests back in September of 1998, just 15 years ago, mm-hmm. and we'll put that to the former assistant U.S. Prosecutor. And then also the strategy of why to arrest them, considering that they perhaps had been a source of information and intelligence coming from Cuba through them into the United States, so spying on the spies from the American point of view.
Sure. Well, and there's two parts to that, and on one part the professor's right, and on one part, unfortunately, he's wrong. The part he's right about is it's true when you're working in counterintelligence, which the FBI does on behalf of the American people every day, it is often better to have the enemy agents where you know they are so you can keep an eye on them so that you don't have to, because if you arrest them, throw them out of the country, whatever it is, then a new group will inevitably come and replace them, and you've got to figure out who those people are and start monitoring them. There's no question. What makes this case different? When the professor says there was no good reason to arrest these five Cuban spies, and actually there was more than five, as you know, we arrested a number mm-hmm. of people. The five went to trial. Several pled guilty.
And I should point out, Professor, you do make that point in your prologue of your book. I think your count to the Cuban five ultimately was 22 or 27. But David, to mm-hmm. your point,
right.
Continue, please.
Well, so when he says there's no good reason, actually there is a good reason. Gerardo Hernandez was involved in a conspiracy to kill four people. And when you do that on U.S. soil, the United States government, and specifically the Department of Justice, has the authority and the job to make prosecutorial decisions and prosecute people, and that was the decision that was made.
Well, why is it that Gerardo Hernandez was not charged with conspiracy to commit murder for a full 7 months after he was arrested? You're telling me that the arrest was because of this, and yet that was not the charge until 7 months later.
There was an amended affidavit,
But 7 months later.
After
you just said that the reason to do this was because he was involved in a conspiracy to commit murder.
No, actually, you said there was no good reason. I said there's actually a very good reason. And what I will tell you is, while I'm not going to get into prosecutorial discussions and prosecutorial decision-making, every day in the federal system, indictments are superseded, more serious charges are brought. The timing of those charges and the reason that they're brought and the reason they're brought when they're brought has to do with strategy sometimes, prosecutorial decision-making, the development of evidence, the development of other testimony. It could be any number of things. And I'm not going
to,
like I said, I'm not going
to
get into the
decision-making. Can you explain to me what it was then that changed in the 7 months that allowed you to file those charges when you did?
I'm not going to get into that because, like I said, it's prosecutorial decision-making. However, if you'll let me finish, the important point is the evidence was developed. The decision was made to prosecute. It was made by the Department of Justice, which is charged with making those kinds of decisions. And
it was made.
You can make up whatever you like, sir, about why you think the Department of Justice did what it did, but you have no evidence of that. You're just stringing together a bunch of suppositions. It's not my job to explain it to you because, as I said, internal decision making of the Department of Justice is not a public matter. What I can tell you is prosecutorial decisions made by the Department of Justice are made based on the facts and evidence in the case. And since I was a prosecutor the entire 8 years I was an assistant U.S. attorney, we were charged with bringing the highest possible charge against every defendant that we could develop probable cause to bring. That is what we did in this case, like we do like the department does every day in the United States.
The September 98, the original indictment did not include the conspiracy to commit murder on the part of defendant Hernandez. Is that correct, David?
You know, I'll be absolutely honest with you. It's been a long time since I looked at the original indictment. Oh, I'll take your word for it. If it wasn't in there, I don't recall.
Isn't that right,
Professor? Don't just take my word for it. Look it up and please report back.
Well, but
it was 7 months, long months. And you had just said to me and to the listeners here that, in fact, the reason for arresting them at the time they did was because Gerardo Hernandez was involved in a
That's not what I said, sir. I didn't say that was the reason for the time. You made the point, sir, that if you're monitoring foreign intelligence agents, why arrest them? Keep an eye on them. And I told you that what makes this case different from other cases the Federal Bureau of Investigation works on every day in this country is that four people died.
So back to the September.
No, wait. Four people died, but he was involved. Nothing about the four people in any of the press conferences, in any of the charges. It was not part of even the discussion.
So let's
at the time of their arrest.
Let's ask
and
this,
the charges.
Ask this direct question, David, if you can answer this. In September of 1998, what was the tipping point in the summer of 98 that led the U.S. Attorney's Office to agree with the FBI, presumably, that charges were prepared to be brought and indictments were ready to go with these five, and arrests now needed to be made in September of 98?
Because I wasn't involved in those discussions, I can't tell you what the tipping point was.
If we could move in just the few remaining minutes that we have, we'd sort of like to sort of tie this up, bringing us up to the present. Professor, if I could ask you a question, and David, if I could ask you a final question. Regarding Alan Gross, Professor, could you tell me just yes or no, do you think that Alan Gross himself received a fair trial in Havana?
I can't answer that in a yes or no, but I can say that your other guest said about questionable evidence. The Associated Press did an investigation of its own and discovered that Alan Gross, rather than simply bringing in communications equipment for the Jewish community, was in fact bringing in a SIM card that was of spy-grade capacity.
And then just quickly, David, if I could ask you, does the fact that we have not prosecuted Luis Posada Carriles for his own terrorist activities or alleged terrorist activities in Cuba, does that not make the United States look a little hypocritical?
I don't think so. And I don't think it's fair to say that we haven't prosecuted Posada Carriles. I wasn't involved in the case out in Texas, and I don't recall all the details, but an action was brought by an arm of the United States against him in Texas. You have to remember, first of all, we have prosecuted Cuban exiles who have been involved in acts of violence against Cuba. The professor brought up Rodolfo Frometa. He was prosecuted by this United States Attorney's Office here in Miami for plotting to shoot down a Cuban airliner using a Stinger missile. We didn't just let that go. He was prosecuted and thrown in jail.
After three arrests for illegal weapons.
Sir, let me finish. You can only prosecute the cases that you have the evidence to prosecute. If the evidence isn't there, you can't bring the cases. I'm not going to deconstruct every single case. I'm not qualified to do that. What I can tell you is this Federal Bureau of Investigation field office, this United States Attorney's Office, both during the time I was there and since, takes every crime of violence seriously, investigates them, and prosecutes them to the full extent of the law.
Thank you very much.
All right, we have to leave it there in our conversation here. Obviously very wide-ranging, obviously very dynamic, but that is what we are here to do. And, Professor, I do want to thank you for your time. Thank you for coming on the program and allowing us to have an intelligent and civil conversation about this very important issue for South Florida. Stephen Kimber has been with us. He has been our guest here on the Florida Roundup. He is a professor of journalism at the University of King's College in Halifax, Canada. The new book entitled What Lies Across the Water, The Real Story of the Cuban Five. And David Buckner, thank you for your time and sharing your insight as well. He was an assistant U.S. attorney back in 1998 through 2001, longer than that, but that was the time period we've been focused on as he was on the prosecutorial team for the Cuban Five. Tim Padgett along with me. I'm Tom Hudson here on WLRN. Stay tuned. South Florida Arts Beat is next. Monday morning at 9, I'll be back with the Sunshine Economy.